We're in the book of Esther. In the book of Esther, chapter 3, King Ahasuerus. Earl, could you put the antenna up? I'm having trouble receiving that. Here we go. King Ahasuerus. He's also known in history as Xerxes. He divorced his wife, whose name was Vashti. He did it because he was having a drinking party one night with all of his buddies. They're all stinking drunk. And he comes up with this wild idea that he's going to parade his wife in front of all of his buddies, show off her beauty. We don't know exactly what that means, but she refuses. And he dumps her. That's all it took for him to dump her. It's after this that Ahasuerus, who is known as Xerxes, he goes off to have this huge grand battle with the Greeks. That's the time, you know, I don't know if anybody you saw the movie 300, the Spartans versus the 2 million Persians. Well, he was the king of the Persians. And they did eventually beat the Spartans. The Spartans only lasted 3 days. We have a whole movie about it, but they only lasted 3 days. But eventually, he was defeated by the Greeks. And when he comes back to Persia, I think it's 3 years later, he comes back to an empty home because he booted his wife out, remember? And so his counselors advise him to hold a beauty contest. And a young gal named Esther wins the contest. She becomes the queen of the empire. Esther was an orphan. She was raised by her cousin, Mordecai. You might call him Morty. I'll try to keep it, official. I'll try to remember him as Mordecai. Last week, we saw that at the end of our section last week that Mordecai had uncovered a plot to assassinate the king. And the perpetrators were arrested, and it's all written down in the records and forgotten about. And I'm just mentioning that because you got to keep that in mind for a couple of weeks from now when that all comes into play. So we're in chapter 3, verse 1. Mordecai won't bow. Verse 1, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. Haman the Agagite. His name Haman means magnificent. I think that means that, like, when he walked down the street, everyone went, "Hey, man." Like, he's just like, I don't know. What do you think? No, my wife's saying, "Oh, honey, go on. Don't try to tell any more jokes tonight." Okay. He's called the Agagite. We think our best guess, it could be that he's from some place called Agag, but there's another Agag in the Bible, and we think that he is a descendant of somebody named Agag, who was the ancient king of the Amalekites. The historian Josephus, he writes around 100 AD, he wrote that he was by birth an Amalekite, this Agag. The Amalekites are an interesting race of people to track them through the Bible. And it is felt by many, including me, that's why I'm going to go off in a little rabbit trail here for a minute, that they are an excellent illustration of sin, of our sin nature, of our flesh. It's not that there's some secret hidden meaning here, but if you want to have an idea of what our sin nature is like to us, if you look at the Amalekites, they're a great illustration. They're a picture of what our sin nature is like, and I'll show you in a minute here. The history of the Amalekites goes back to the Exodus. Actually, they show up in Genesis. They're listed in one of the genealogies of Genesis. But the first time we see them written into history goes back to the time when Moses has brought the people out of Egypt and they're wandering in the wilderness. And the trouble with the Amalekites came, we read in Deuteronomy 25:18, God is speaking to the people. He met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear. When you were tired and weary, he did not fear God. That's how the Amalekites operated. They attacked the stragglers. You know, the pregnant ladies that are trying to get through the wilderness and keep up with everybody. The people that came down with the cold and the flu and are kind of dragging and stuff like that behind. They're a little bit behind everybody else. And those are the people the Amalekites would come and raid. They didn't attack the strength of the nation. They would attack the weak parts of the nation. And gang, that is a good picture of what our sin nature does. It attacks us when we're weak. When you've probably experienced this, when you've gone through a particularly rough time, it's been an extra hard week, you're exhausted. You've been through a lot of difficulties and you're mentally wiped out. Don't be surprised when you get these difficult temptations. Because that's when your sin nature is going to attack. It's going to happen. I see it with me all the time. That's how the enemy works. He likes to attack. And the problem with the sin nature, it's not somebody else, it's part of me, is when I'm weak. Now, because of these Amalekites' tactics, Moses sent Joshua and his troops to fight them. You read about this in Exodus 17, where it says, "Now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim, and Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose some men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of in my hand.'" The rod of God, that's the thing that he held out, the big stick, that parted the Red Sea. You know what I'm talking about? "I will stand on top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand." So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And so it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. Now, don't think that Moses has magic hands or that this is a magic stick, the goofy part of me would think, maybe it's the rod, it's the magic rod. And I would kind of go up, down, up, down, up, down, 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 up, up, up. I'd probably play with it or something. It was something like that. That's not what this is about. He's lifting up his hands in prayer. That's what this is all about. And prayer, my friends, is a major element of having victory over the flesh. Joshua, now don't get me wrong, prayer isn't the only thing. Joshua and his army are still swinging their swords and thrusting with their spears. They still have to physically fight the battle. But when they are strengthened through prayer, they're having the victory. The battles that you and I face, you still got to swing your swords. You still got to do the right things. Maybe it's some kind of an accountability thing. Might be the thing that you need with your particular kind of sin. It could be. Sometimes that's helpful with some people to have people who are along for the ride who can help you out. Sometimes it's getting counseling. Sometimes God works through people who have wisdom, have some knowledge about how people work, and they can point you in the right direction. Sometimes, believe it or not, sometimes the problems you face that seem like mental problems, that you think it's all in your head, sometimes there's a physiological thing behind it. Can be. It could be that it could be you need to go to a doctor. Could be you need to take meds. Oh my gosh, you mean, Pastor Rich, you don't just believe that you can just pray and everything is healed? No, I God works through prayer. God can heal through prayer. I was reading something today, and it was like, well, duh. If somebody's, has heart disease, most of us don't think, well, we'll send in the pastors and we'll pray for them and they'll be healed of their heart disease. Well, we might send in the pastors and pray for them, but you still go and have your heart surgery, don't you? Nothing lacking in faith there. And sometimes there's physiological things you need to address. But the point here is that with whatever it is, whatever way you're swinging your sword, it's enhanced when you lift up your hands and you pray. When somebody's praying, Handle these things with prayer. Get God involved in the process. And it goes on in our passage here in Exodus, but Moses' hands became heavy. You never tried that? You ever tried? Every once in a while, some of you get like really Pentecostal and you hold up your hands during all the worship, you know? You know, not too many of you do. I see you out there. Not a whole lot of you have your hands up, but that's okay. That's okay. But you know, if you're not used to it, you know, sometimes about halfway through the first song, you're going, your hands get kind of heavy and you go, I'm lifting up my hands. I'm tired. You know, you can't, and his hands got heavy. Where am I? I'm in verse 12. So his hands became heavy. So they took a stone, put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side. And his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. Sometimes even with prayer, you can't do it on your own. You need to bring in some help. You need to have others who can support you. That's kind of what church is supposed to be about. The hard thing is that some of us think church is just about coming to the thing where you all sit and face me the same direction and you listen to me gab at you. Don't get me wrong, that's a part of it. But a part of church is connecting with people. Well, how do I do that? Well, you probably need to get involved with some of the smaller groups. Whether it's the ladies' studies, whether it's the men's studies, whether it's running the soundboard. I got a check mark for that one. I wouldn't have thought of that. But finding a group to serve with, finding a group to connect with, finding people to share with who you can call and ask for prayer. That's part of how we have help over the flesh. And it says, verse 13, back in Exodus, so Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Amalek. Haman the Agagite. One other lesson I want to talk about before we move off of the first verse. I know I'm really dragging out the first verse. I apologize. But I'm calling this finish well. See, the battle with Amalek pops up several times through the scripture. And the next time the Amalekites pop up is during the time of King Saul. God gave King Saul a mission. The prophet Samuel came to him and said, you know, it's time to finish what God told the Amalekites he was going to do. It's time to get rid of them. Time to deal with them completely. Wipe them out. These are bad people. Really, really bad people. And though Saul had victory, he kind of stopped short a little bit. He wiped out the stuff that was, anybody would wipe them out. You know, the stuff that's ugly and bad. But he decided he'd keep some of the nice stuff. I don't know if he's thinking of some of the sheep and the oxen and the stuff that makes for good barbecue. You know, this might be nice. We'll save the barbecue stuff, you know. And he also spared one important Amalekite in the group that he fought, and that was a fellow named Agag, the king of the Amalekites. This is what Samuel said to Saul. Now the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord? And Saul said to Samuel, but I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and have gone on the mission on which God had sent me and brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people, it's their fault. They took of the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal, and sacrifices means barbecue. I mean, it's, you know, get a little nice barbecue sauce and spices on there. You know, I guess the men had a barbecue on Monday. Did it come off okay? Was it thumb? Oh, okay. So Samuel said, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed, to obey, than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king. Saul felt like he'd done enough, and he stopped short of doing all that he was supposed to do. And Samuel clarifies, buddy, you didn't go far enough. You didn't go far enough. Sometimes when I'm dealing with a particular sin in my life, do you have a particular sin in your life that you struggle with? Do you? Nobody's there going to nod at that one. I'm not going to nod my head to the person. She's going to see me nod. I've got a sin in my life. Does anybody want to admit they have a particular sin they struggle with? I got them. And sometimes, my friend, we get motivated and we do a little to work on it. And then we stop short. We start feeling good about ourselves. We start feeling like, hey, I've arrived. I stopped half of it. Stop all of it. Go all the way. Finish it. And even once you've finished it, don't think that you're done. Sometimes we give people the impression that, you know, follow the Lord, he'll deliver you from your sin, and you won't ever have to worry about it again. And you'll hear people talk about, you know, God delivered me from this, and God delivered me from that, and I don't ever do that again. I hope. But friends, I would rather be wary of my own sin nature. Because I found that in some of my sins, I'll get victory for a while. And then out of the clear blue, bam, it hits me. Even though Samuel would Samuel actually took care of Agag. Agag would die like, you know, a few minutes from this point. But there was enough Amalekites left. In fact, you find later on in 1 Samuel that David's fighting Amalekites. If Saul wiped them all out, how come David is fighting them when you get to chapter 30? Because Saul didn't wipe them out. And by Esther's day, there is one heck of a grudge match waiting for Israel. And in fact, what the book of Esther is all about is the rising up of the Agagites to wipe out Israel. And that's what our flesh will do. You leave it unchecked, it will rise up, it will try to destroy you. Okay, let's do a second verse. I promise to go a little faster. Or maybe not. Verse 2. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gates bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. So, King Ahasuerus has raised up, he's promoted this fellow named Haman, and he's told everybody, you ought to like bow before Haman. You ought to pay homage to him. But Mordecai did not bow. Now, paying homage to Haman, there is a test going on here. I'll call it the exaltation test. Sometimes we think of tests in our lives as only being the difficult things. When I lose my job, I get sick, grandma dies, things happen, you know, and all these kind of things. We think of those as tests. That's good. But some tests don't have to do with difficulty. Sometimes tests have to do with abundance. How do you respond when you're blessed? What would you do if you won the lottery? Wow! Would anybody like to win the lottery? I'll put my hand up. That would be kind of cool. I kind of like that idea. What if you get promoted? You get that promotion that you're looking for. you're going to see with Haman that he doesn't do well with exaltation. He doesn't do well with promotion. It's going to go straight to his head. I've seen people fail these tests. We all want our lives to be easier. We all want to have recognition or power. And yet sometimes those things are the things that put us on our face. I've seen power go to a person's head, you know, giving somebody a promotion. And then they start thinking that they need to control everybody's lives around them.
Eek.
Not good. Verse 3, another verse. Then the king's servants who were within the king's gates said to Mordecai, "Well, why do you transgress the king's command?" Because remember, Mordecai wasn't bowing. And that's because he's a Jew. This is the second command of the Ten Commandments. You shall not bow down to them, which is anything, nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Jews won't bow to anybody but God. And so Mordecai is a good Jew. He's not going to bow down. Verse 4, now it happened, when they spoke to him daily, and he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman, to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. Little red lights are going off in Haman's head. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. Now, you could say this is a good sample that Haman's not passing his exaltation test. He's not doing very well with it because not everybody's bowing down and kissing his little toesies like he wants them to. You know, most of us are in some kind of a place of authority. Maybe you might be the boss of everything. You could just simply be a parent of a child. But how do you respond when you don't get your way? If you get angry at the people who are underneath you that's supposed to be doing what you say, well, then you're acting like Haman. Sometimes our anger gets us into trouble. A big shot, he had to spend a couple of days in the hospital. He was a royal pain to the nurses because he bossed them around just like he did his employees. None of the hospital staff wanted to have anything to do with him. The head nurse was the only one who could stand up to him. She walked into his room and announced, "I have to take your temperature." After complaining for several minutes, he finally settled down, crossed his arms, and opened his mouth. "No, I'm sorry," said the nurse, "but for this reading, I can't use an oral thermometer." This started another round of complaining, but eventually he rolled over and bared his behind. After feeling the nurse insert the thermometer, he heard her announce, "I have to get something. Now you stay just like that until I get back." And she leaves the door to his room open on her way out. He curses under his breath as he hears people walking past his door laughing. After almost an hour, the man's doctor comes into the room. "What's going on here?" asks the doctor. Angrily, the man answers, "What's the matter, Doc? Haven't you ever seen someone have their temperature taken before?" After a pause, the doctor replies, "Yeah, but not with a daffodil." So anger can get you into trouble. And don't misunderstand me here. If you are in a place of authority, it's proper to be expecting people under you to do what you ask. That's what authority is about. But if you respond with anger, you have a problem. It's the anger that's the problem, not people respecting or disrespecting you. It's the anger. Ephesians 6:9 in the Message translation says this: "Masters," that's the people with authority, "masters, it's the same with you. No abuse, please, and no you and your servants are both under the same master in heaven. He makes no distinction between you and them." That's how bosses are supposed to be acting. No abuse, no threats. Verse 6. But this is Haman. "But Haman disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. It's bad enough that that Mordecai doesn't bow to Haman, but these things with him being a Jew, that's it. And he's going to do more than deal with Mordecai. He wants to wipe out the Jews. Verse 7. Haman's final solution. You know, in World War II, Hitler devised his own final solution to what he called the Jewish question. His plan was to wipe out the Jewish race. Hitler's idea wasn't an original idea. You see it happening right here with Haman. Haman's doing the exact same thing. Verse 7. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, not Toyota, but that month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot, before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Now, the 12th year means that Esther and Ahasuerus have been married for 5 years, just to kind of set the stage from you can track of when they got married. It's now been, they just had their 5-year anniversary. And it says they cast Pur before him. The word Pur is an Assyrian word, which means of the lot. It's, you could think of it as throwing dice. It's, you know, casting lots is kind of like throwing dice. And the word Pur is where we get the word Purim from. The Jews celebrate the feast of Purim. Purim is plural. So it comes from the idea that the name of the feast comes from these guys casting their Purim. That's where they get the name of the feast of Purim. Haman is a bit of a superstitious kind of a fellow. And instead of just deciding a day when he's going to wipe out the Jews, he has to come up with some way of determining the best day to wipe them out. And so they start tossing their little dice thing. And as it ends up on the 12th month, which will give the Jews 11 months to prepare. Proverbs 16:33 says the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. I asked David to do the song Sovereign again tonight, because there is a sense, gang, that God has his hand on things. And that's what Proverbs 16:33 is about, is that you can do this lot casting thing, but God can handle, he can change the way the dice roll. He can do that if he wants. Now, does this mean that we ought to go around tossing dice every time we need to make a decision? I don't know, should I have wheat bread or white bread on with my hamburger? I don't know. Let me get out my magic dice and cast the dice, you know, and some people can go down this road. I think God would prefer that you just use your brain, personally, my friends. I have no qualms about that. I don't think there's anything spiritual. I think you can get into dangerous stuff if you try to live your life by drawing straws or casting dice. Proverbs 24:6 says, by wise counsel you will wage your own war, and in a multitude of counselors there is safety. Use your brain. If you get into this, you know, magical stuff, throwing dice or whatever you do, you know, God could use that every once in a while. But if you're going to stick with that, God's probably going to make you look like a fool. He's going to say, okay, so you don't want to, like, listen to me? You don't want to, like, use the brain I gave you? Well, then let's just watch you ruin your life. And, you know, probably, you know, who knows? But at this point, because of this situation, God makes sure that this thing is going to land so that they've got 11 months. And see God's hand at work. Verse 8. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. Now, I find it interesting. He doesn't say who these people are. He just say there's these people out there, you know. And he's making a case that you ought to just like order them all to be killed, you know. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries. He says, I'm going to pay 10,000 talents. That's roughly about $240 million in our sense. That's something like 20 million pounds or ounce. 20 million ounces is what it is. Something like that. I don't know. Oh, 12 million ounces. That's what it is. I forget. I did all the math earlier today. It's a lot of money. Josephus gives us the idea that Haman is trying to make up for the future lost revenue in losing tax money from the Jews. So he's going to finance this entire operation out of his own pocket is what he's offering to do. And so he's kind of bribing the king, making it really easy. Just sign right here on the dotted line, and I'll take care of everything. Now, Haman's going to get it all back because when they wipe these people out, they'll take their land and their property and their fine pieces of art and their jewelry, just like Hitler did. You know, they'll get it all back. Verse 10. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha of the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The signet ring, the idea is to put his stamp of approval on the decree, probably making an impression in the wax or something of that sort, and to make it official. Verse 11, and the king said to Haman, the money and the people are given to you to do with them as it seems good to you. NIV translates it here. Keep the money, the king says to Haman, and do with the people as you please. Hey, you know, you don't even have to pay for it. I'll pay for it. This sounds like a good thing. Even though he doesn't really know what he's asking for. Verse 12. Especially because one of those peoples, is his wife. Ha! Verse 12. Then the king's scribes, of course, even Haman doesn't know that. Verse 12. Then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all people, to every province according to its script, and to every people in their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus, it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the month of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. So the 13th day of the 12th month is when this is going to happen. The Jews, again, are given 11 months to be prepared. They will be wiped out, supposedly, on March 7th, 473 B.C. And part of this decree is whoever kills a Jew gets to keep his stuff. It's supposed to happen, it says, on the 13th day. Some people have suggested that's where the concept comes from, 13 being an unlucky number from this event. That's what some suggest. Who knows? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Verse 14, a copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people that they should be ready for that day. The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. The city of Shushan was perplexed. Everybody's scratching their heads like, what happened here? What's this all about? And imagine, most of all, the Jews are perplexed. There was one of the songs that David did tonight. You kind of reflected this thought. I think it was the last song. I don't know. Let me just say this, gang. It ain't over. Things look bad, but just wait. It ain't over. For one thing, they've still got 11 months. They've still got 11 months to figure this out. And God, whether they realize it or not, has his people in place. This is not a surprise to God. Jeremiah wrote, "For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, says the Lord, thoughts of peace, not of evil, to give you a future and a hope." Now, I'm not going to give you a message about how everything's going to turn out bright and cheery. Because some of our worst fears actually do happen. Sometimes the person you're worried about dies. How many of you have ever had a close loved one die? Okay, look around. See, it happens. I'm not trying to scare you. This is reality. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes you don't get the promotion. Sometimes you get canned. Sometimes the marriage doesn't work out. That doesn't mean that God's finished. That doesn't mean that it's over. I think about Joseph. He was the favorite of his father, and his brothers hated him for it. One day, Joseph is kidnapped by his brothers, carried off to Egypt, thinking his life is over. But God was with him. He was working as a slave when his master's wife starts hitting on him. And he ends up being thrown into prison unjustly for something he didn't do. A couple of important guys get thrown into prison. He helps them out. He's hoping that they're going to get a few words in for him. And they leave, and they promptly forget him. And he sits in prison for 2 more years. And finally the day comes when God pulls all the plans together, the plans that God had for Joseph. He interprets the Pharaoh's dream and ends up becoming the second most powerful man in the world. And when the famine hits the world, Joseph ends up saving his own family from destruction. It ain't over, gang. It ain't over. You are still here. Every one of you are still here. It ain't over. If you are still here, it isn't over. God knows the plans that he has for you. It ain't over. Chapter 4. When Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out in the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry. Sackcloth is kind of like burlap. It's kind of like wearing a burlap bag. Sometimes sackcloth is worn right under the skin instead of underwear. It's not comfortable. It's not meant to be comfortable. Josephus tells us what words were, that he said, "A nation that has been injurious to no man was to be destroyed. How can this be fair? We haven't hurt anybody, and yet we're supposed to be wiped out." Verse 2, "He went as far as the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth." He can't get any further towards the palace than the king's gate because of his sackcloth. It seemed like the Persian kings don't want unhappy people around them. If you're depressed, you are not allowed to be close to the king. I think there's like a restraining order or something in place. No unhappy people are allowed within 100 yards of the king. This is just a standing rule. Nehemiah was aware of this. Nehemiah writes, "Therefore the king said to me, 'Why is your face sad since you are not sick? There is nothing but sorrow of heart.'" And Nehemiah says, "So I became dreadfully afraid. Because I'm like breaking the rules here. Because I couldn't crack a smile." What Nehemiah says when he was thinking about what bad shape Jerusalem was in. The Persian kings didn't like unhappy people. Verse 3. "And in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping, and wailing. And many lay in sackcloth and ashes. So Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her, and the queen was deeply distressed. Then she sent garments to clothe Mordecai and take his sackcloth away from him, and he would not accept them. She hears that Mordecai is wearing sackcloth, and he's like wailing and crying, and like she doesn't know yet what's going on. All she knows is that her cousin is, which is like her dad, is very depressed, and she doesn't like this. And so she sends some clothes and sends a message to try to cheer him up. And for Mordecai, he won't allow it. He won't wear her clothes that she sends. I imagine for Mordecai, it's hardest on him because I think he realizes this is all because of him. His whole nation is about to be wiped out because of him. She tries to have him change his clothes and be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Be happy. Put on a happy face. Come on, buddy. You can, you know, kind of smile. You can do that. You know what? Sometimes when we're going through difficult times, and I know some of you have experienced this, and you are having a really hard time, and people try to cheer you up, and you know they mean well, but sometimes it just really sucks, doesn't it? Because they don't get it. They don't understand. Romans 12:15 says, look at this, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. I know sometimes we're meaning well when we want to try to make a little smile come out, you know, but sometimes the better thing is to weep with them. Or at least shut up. And it's okay to say, I don't know what to say. That's okay. That's okay. But sometimes you can't force people to smile. Verse 5. Then Esther called Hatak, one of the king's eunuchs, who he had appointed to attend her. And she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. Now, apparently, Esther is not allowed out in public. She doesn't know what the decree is. And he can't come into the palace. So she has to send her messenger, Hatak, out to find out what's going on. So Hatak went out to Mordecai in the city square that was in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given at Shushan, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. And so Mordecai sends Hatak back, and he's asking his cousin, his daughter, to help her own people out. And by the way, at this point, whether he's known it or not, at this point, Hatak knows that she's a Jew. The Jews. Esther's a Jew. Esther's a Jew. Esther's a Jew. Wipe out the Jews. Esther's a Jew. Oh my. Oh my. So Hatak returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai. Then Esther spoke to Hatak and gave him a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called has but one law, put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. Now, it seems that the Persian kings didn't like to be bothered. They didn't want any interruptions. Herodotus, the ancient historian, talks about who started all this and stuff. And he talks about how they even had guards standing there with axes. Sometimes you see that in the movies. They're standing there with axes. And that's because if somebody didn't have an invitation, whoosh, off with their head. You know, it's just like, don't bother the guy. Now, I kind of get that every once in a while. You know, I've got sometimes, like after Sunday, and not that I'm that important of a person, but sometimes after Sunday I'll have like two or three people standing wanting to talk to me. And then somebody comes barreling up the aisle and wants to butt in and interrupt and get out of line, and because they are more important than everybody else. Now, I can say that because none of you are that person. But it happens. Or you know, you have it like at, you know, work. You've got a pile this big on your desk, and then somebody decides that, Lori knows this, Lori's like my best protection. You know, she tries to head him off at the door, you know, especially like on Fridays when I'm trying to get my pastor to person article written so that she can do the bulletin and go home. And I'm just like dragging my feet and distracted about this and that. And somebody walks in, you know, and Lori, we ought to try the golden scepter thing. You know, that if I don't give me a golden scepter, and if I don't hold out the golden scepter, of course, you know me, I'm the sucker. I'll hold it out for anybody. You know, I don't know. So I get it. I kind of get it. But what Esther's saying is that she's going to risk her own life if she dares to approach the king without first being summoned. Because that's just the way things work around here. She says, I have not been called for these 30 days. Now, I just got to say this. Again, I mentioned this last week. Esther and Ahasuerus, this is not like the marriage you want to emulate. I just want to say that, okay? This is not like, this is not a marriage you should want to copy, okay? They haven't seen each other for 30 days. You know, some things are just not appropriate for marriage, like some of these songs.
Yeah, man. I'll tell you what, music helps us out a lot. I love to sing. I love to sing. I sing in weddings, believe it or not. Why don't y'all shut your mouth? I had a friend call me not too long ago. He said, dude, I'm getting married. I want you to sing at my wedding. I'm like, okay, I'd be honored. When are you getting married? He goes, in 2 weeks. I'm like, well, thanks for the heads up. I said, well, what do you, when you want? He goes, well, my friend, I wanted to sing. He fell through, so I called you. Well, I'm flattered. Thank you. I said, okay, when do you want me to sing to the wedding? He goes, well, when the bride's walking down the aisle, I want you to sing then. You sure about that? Oh. Okay, well, what do you want me to sing? He goes, you pick. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. Half of me's going, no way. The other half of me's like, I can make this a wedding no one's ever going to forget. There's a lot of songs wouldn't go well, very appropriate at a wedding. We're walking down that. What's love got to do? Got to do?
That wouldn't be very appropriate.
Heard it from a friend who, heard it from a friend who, heard it from another you've been messing around.
That wouldn't be good at all.
She's my best friend's girl, but she used to be mine.
That wouldn't be. I might lose a friend over that one.
Oh, there's worse. But I still haven't found what I'm looking for. You can't always get what you want, but you can try sometimes. You might find you get what you need. Yeah.
Who gives this woman?
Cut.
I'm sorry. We're going to cut that. That's not going to be on the show.
So my whole point is this. There are some things that are not appropriate for marriage. And Ahasuerus and Esther are not an example you want to follow. For example, it is not good when one spouse is afraid of seeing the other. Did you see that in her? She's like, now you better pray for me because it's scary to go visit my husband. That just ain't right. But you know what? That happens. Shouldn't ought to be, but it happens. And it's also probably not good if you haven't seen each other for 30 days. And that's a regular occurrence. That's probably not like a very healthy thing. I know sometimes things have to happen, you know, like that. And but not on a regular thing. I mean, come on, Ahasuerus. Verse 12. So they told Mordecai Esther's words. And Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews." You know, he's saying, girl, if you don't do anything, you're going to be dead just like all of us. Verse 14, for if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Now first he says deliverance will arise. Relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. And I got to just say this. There is truth to this, gang. God really doesn't need you. Sometimes we can inflate our own importance to ourselves, that if we aren't at every event, that if we don't do everything, that if we don't micromanage every little detail, that God's plans are not going to happen. And, you know, that's probably thinking a little more too highly of yourself than you ought, because God's big enough to take care of things without you. So now, there will be times, though, when you are the one. And you can't escape that. The other thing I want to say is that you just point out, I just love this phrase. How do you not know? Who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? God has things he wants you to do. Ephesians 2:10 says, we are his workmanship created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. The fact that we are God's workmanship means that he's been at work in us. He's been doing stuff in our lives. And the reason he's been doing work in our lives is because he has stuff for us to do. People to see, places to go, things to do. You see with Esther, this is the beauty of this story, is that God uses everything. He uses all the details. It is no mistake that her parents died and she was an orphan because she was raised by Mordecai. It is no mistake that she wins the beauty contest. That is not a mistake. It is no mistake that Mordecai becomes a leader. Remember last week he was the one sitting in the gate. He's one of the leaders. That's not by mistake. It is no mistake we saw last week that he saved the king's life. Remember, he discovered the assassination plot. And it gets recorded because that little detail is going to play into the whole story. It's no mistake. It is no mistake that Esther is queen of the empire. How do you not know, girl, that you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Sometimes we get to thinking that God could never use us. Well, who do you think he's wanting to use? He wants to use you. All of who you are. All of the things you think are mistakes, God wants to use. I'm going to skip this. God has made you to be unique. All of your strengths, all of your weaknesses. You have a purpose. There is a reason you are alive on this planet today. There's a reason. It's got things for you to do. You may think that there's been terrible mistakes, terrible tragedies, terrible accidents in your life. You are wrong. You are wrong. God wants to work. They may be the very things that God will use to fulfill his good works that he's planned for you. Verse 15, I got to wrap this up. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." I love it. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. She asks them to fast for me. She's not asking them to fast because they're a little overweight. You know, you at least lose a little pounds there, Mort, you know, looking a little heavy. No, she's asking for prayer. She's asking for serious prayer. Josephus records what was believed to be her prayer. She entreated God to have mercy upon her and make her words appear persuasive to the king and render her countenance more beautiful than it was before, that both by her words and beauty she might succeed for the averting of the king's anger in case he were at all irritated against her, and for the consolation of those of her own country, now they were in the utmost danger of perishing, as also that he would excite a hatred in the king against the enemies of the Jews and those that had contrived their future destruction if they proved to be condemned by him. Now, we don't know for sure because it's not in Scripture that that's what she prayed, but it's kind of cool because those are the things that happened. Those are exactly what God did. And we're going to see God answer her prayer in an awesome way. Let's stand. Let's pray.